We need to grow. This is, you know, it is a process. It's not something, no one becomes chaste as a child and remains perfectly chaste the rest of their lives. This is a battle at various stages of our lives. We certainly know that when we hit adolescence, it becomes a major battle at that point as our bodies begin to change dramatically. And we suddenly are having to deal with all of these emotions and these feelings. But a great deal of this growth is moving from selfishness to selflessness. From selfishness to selflessness. We are born radically selfish. And again, I always have people who disagree with that, who say, no, babies are born, they're just perfect little loving things. All right? And I say, that is absolutely not true. All right? Your child is not born loving you. Your child is born not caring one whit whether you get any sleep or not, whether you get to have a shower for days on end, all right? Whether you get any time to yourself, your baby doesn't care about you. Your baby cares only about itself. And yes, it will smile and gurgle and everything to you if you're meeting all of its needs, all right? If you are obeying its divine will, all right? That's when your baby will show you, I love you. I love you, mommy, because you're doing everything I demand, all right? And as soon as you don't, I'm going to create noises that will make you so uncomfortable that you will almost be ready to lose your mind, all right? Is this not true? Is this not true? So we are born radically selfish. This is what original sin is in us, is this tendency to radical self-centeredness, to thinking of ourselves first and maybe only. And we have to learn, our parents have to teach us, and then at some point we have to take up the battle of learning how to not allow that tendency to selfishness to run our lives. To learn to grow in selflessness, in learning how to give of ourselves, to give ourselves away. This means also learning to see other people as subjects rather than objects. All right? That we are born seeing other people as objects. Mom and Dad are objects. They are there to meet my needs. Every other human being in the world is there to meet my needs. The entire universe is there to meet my needs. And we have to learn that that's not true, to begin to see that every other person is another person who has rights, who has needs, and we have to respect them. We have to respect them as individual human beings, just like ourselves, as subjects, not objects. So there's self-mastery, there is growth from selfishness to selflessness. And then thirdly, the chapter talks about that chastity is a moral virtue, which is a gift from God and dependent on His grace. In other words, you and I will never become truly chaste on our own. No matter how hard we try, we will never be able to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and force ourselves into genuine chastity. All right? That is a gift from God that is dependent upon His grace. And so, if I want to be a truly chaste man or woman, I have to continually come to God seeking His graces. That's why we come to the Mass. We come to the Eucharist. Well, one of the reasons is so that we can gain the graces of that sacrament, the enormous graces of that sacrament, and bring them to bear in all the aspects of our lives, but particularly tonight we're talking about in the area of our sexuality, to begin to grow there. That's why we go to the sacrament of reconciliation, to do battle with the sinfulness that is a part of us, that selfishness that is a part of us, that brokenness, to go into to heal so that we can become the men and women that God intended us to be. And none of us will ever be able to live lives of genuine chastity without the graces of those sacraments. It will not happen. It will not happen by our own efforts, by itself. Now, let's look at some of the particular issues. All right, on page 406 of your book, we can get into more of the negative side of this now, where it's about what are the problems? What are the problems that are associated with this? And but halfway down where it begins with the bullet points, all right, we're going to talk about each one of these just a little bit. Lust. Lust is a disordered desire for or an inordinate enjoyment of sexual pleasure, especially when sought for itself. Now, a lot of people confuse lust and sexual desire. A lot of people think that lust and sexual desire are exactly the same thing. And so then we're saying that lust is wrong, then we're saying that sexual desire is wrong. And that is not the truth at all. Where does sexual desire come from? It's a gift from God. It is a gift that God has given to us. And so holy, healthy sexual desire and lust are not the same thing. What is the difference? What's the difference? Holy, healthy sexual desire is God's gift to us so that we will fall in love and give ourselves away completely to another. All right? To completely give ourselves away to another person. To make that ultimate, absolute commitment that is marriage. All right? That's what holy, healthy sexual desire leads us to. And then, through that love, to the procreation of children. That's holy, healthy sexual desire. What's lust? Lust has nothing to do with my giving myself away. It is about my taking. Lust is a perversion of what God intended sexual desire to be. It is a twisting of sexual desire, and it is a taking from another. It is a using of another person. It is turning another person into an object for my own sake. And that can be my own spouse. I can be my own spouse. I remember when Pope John Paul II was giving his series of talks on the theology of the body, and he was talking about that passage about that a man who looks at a woman with lust in his heart has already committed adultery. And he made the point that that could also be within marriage, that a person who looks at their spouse with lust in their heart has committed adultery. And I remember there was an explosion because people didn't understand what he was saying. All right? He was not saying if you look at your spouse with holy, healthy sexual desire, there's anything wrong with that. But if you look at your spouse with lust, there's something very definitely wrong with that. I've talked to many, many people, it's usually women, who are saying, my husband's sexual desire for me is not healthy. It is not loving. It is not self-giving. He sees me as an object. He sees me as someone to be used. And that is true, you know, in a lot of marriages, that there is that struggle. There is that struggle. So lust is a disordered sexual desire, all right, which is essentially selfish rather than selfless. Masturbation is sinful because it misuses the gift of sexuality in an inherently selfish act devoid of love. There is obviously no love taking place when masturbation is the issue. All right, it is a completely selfish act. It is a problem for which a counselor, spiritual director, or confessor can be of considerable help. A person often needs assistance to understand the causes of this behavior, which are often habitual, or in response to emotional stress or unexamined underlying attitudes. So a lot of times, and this is very, very true, I see this very often in confession and talking to people, is that people who are struggling with this sin, it's not always really about lust. A lot of times what has happened is that people have learned to use masturbation as a drug. It's a way of relieving stress. It's a way of escaping from tension, right? Or it has become something that is habitual and addictive, and it can become addictive. And it may have underlying causes. And in order to stop, it's not enough to simply say, you've got to stop that. You've got to stop doing that. That there's spiritual work that very often has to be done. That person has to look at what's going on in his or her life and why they're making this choice. And for instance, if they are using it as a drug, then what they have to do, if they're going to be able to break free of that, they're going to have to find healthy, positive ways of dealing with stress and anxiety and loneliness in their lives, all right? Or they're not going to be successful at breaking free of this pattern of using masturbation to do that. So, it's a process. Fornication, sexual intercourse between unmarried persons, is sinful because it violates the dignity of human persons and the nuptial meaning and purpose of sexuality, which is that complete giving of ourselves to another and that openness to procreation, which is ordered only to the unitive and procreative goals of married people. When I was teaching high school, there was a phrase we used to say to the kids, don't write a check with your body that your life can't cash. Any of you have ever heard that? All right? Don't write a check with your body that your life can't cash. What do we say with our bodies in the sexual act? We are saying, I give myself to you completely and absolutely, holding nothing back. All right? I give myself to you entirely entirely and wholly, right? And it's not true. And it's not true. I may be, even if I, let's just even, you know, first of all, there can be those people who don't love each other at all, and it's just sex, all right? But let's say that it's an unmarried couple who do love one another, but who are not ready to make a commitment of marriage. That's a lie. Every time they make love, it's a lie. They are saying, they are writing a check with their bodies. I love you completely and absolutely, and I give myself to you entirely and fully. And the reality is, I'm not doing that. I don't give myself to you that way. All right? Does that make sense? All right? This is why it's wrong. It is a great lie. It is a great lie. And then, because that couple had been telling that lie to each other through their whole dating experience, that lie gets carried into the marriage. That lie gets carried into the marriage. And already, because now, that act of love that they are making, which is supposed to be the renewal of their marriage covenant, their sacramental covenant, is still tainted by lie. It's still tainted by lie that we've been telling each other all along, right? And so there's a real healing and conversion and transformation that needs to happen there. This is why, you know, a lot of people in our culture believe, most of the couples that get married are already living together. All right. Supposedly, 60% of all couples today who are getting married are living together, and that's pretty much true. My experiences of those who are coming to the church to be married. All right, that 60% of them are living together, and the common wisdom of our culture is that if you are living together before marriage, that is going to be good for the marriage. All right, because first of all, you're going to find out whether you are really compatible or not, all right? Compatible in any number of ways. And so the presumption is this is going to make marriages healthier and stronger. The reality is that couples who live together before marriage have a much higher divorce rate than couples who do not. Why? Because they've begun with a trial marriage that says, psychologically, if this doesn't work out, we can always put an end to this. We can stop, we can get out of this, all right? If this doesn't work out, guess what? That gets carried into the marriage. That gets carried into the marriage. There's attitudes of that, you know, again, really, what you're doing is you're test driving a marriage. You're test driving a marriage. That can't be good for a marriage. That cannot be good for a marriage, for a relationship, if you're treating it like you're test driving a car. You know, you're either making a commitment in your marriage that you're in it and you're going to do it forever, or you're not. And it's not about, okay, well, if I find out that I don't like the fact that you don't put the cap on the toothpaste, or that we have radically different sexual appetites, that then I'm going to divorce you. No, you're either in this marriage forever or you're not in this marriage forever. If you go into the marriage with the idea that if there's things about this person that I find unpalatable, I'm out of it, you're going to get out of it. Sooner or later, you're going to get out of it. And even those couples who go into it, if they've been living together ahead of time, in a subconscious way, all right, they are bringing some of those same attitudes into the marriage. Very, very destructive of marriage. It really is. It really is. Okay, let's move on. Incest, sexual relationships between close relatives, is always wrong, harming both the individuals involved as well as the family itself. Sexual abuse of any kind harms the victim on many more levels than only the physical. Forcing sexual intimacy of any type on a children or minor is of even greater evil, which often scars the victim for life. I've dealt with many people who were sexually abused as kids, and that is absolutely true. I don't think you ever completely get past that. I don't think you ever, no matter how much healing I've seen happen to people, and I've seen remarkable healing, it's all, there's a wound. There was a young man I knew who was abused. He was abused when he was about 12 or 13 by a neighbor. And he was in his 20s when he was talking to me. I remember him talking, he said, you know, if he had beaten me, it would have really wounded my body. He said, but what this did, he says, it was like he stabbed me into my soul. All right, all the way down to the core of my being. And that has been my experience in dealing with people who were sexually abused as children, is the wounds go all the way down. The wounds go all the way down. And they can make remarkable progress in healing from that. but that it never goes away. There is always something that is left there that will require some perfect healing that will come from God in the next life. But that's why it's so horrific. It is so horrific. When a child is sexually abused, it was going to affect that child's life in innumerable ways for the rest of their lives. So, pornography, sexually explicit material, has become even more available through the internet. This presents real difficulties for both individuals and society, as viewing pornography is not only sinful in itself, but can also become an addiction and lead to dangerous sexual behaviors. It's also led to a greater exploitation of children as sexual objects. What I have read and learned is that there is far more child pornography out there than any of us would ever imagine. That means that there are children who are being sexually abused on camera, right? And that is being disseminated throughout the world, and that the numbers on that are enormous, far beyond what we would expect. But also we know that pornography is a big, big problem. You know, as I always say, I think, you know, if you go back 30 years, if you wanted pornography, you would probably have to go out to a seedy shop on the edge of town and be afraid somebody was going to see your car parked there, and it was kind of a shameful kind of thing. Now it comes right into your house, all right? Comes right into your office. It just comes onto your, it'll come onto your phone, all right, if you want it to. Wherever you are, pornography will come, all right? And I always think, you know, because it is addictive, and I mean, if cocaine came into our homes and into our lives as easily and as readily as pornography, I wonder how many cocaine addicts we'd see running around. I think a lot, all right? It is incredible the amount of pornography that is being fed into our society. And many, many people, primarily men, all right, are the ones that, you know, it's not women who are spending billions of dollars on pornography, all right? They may be the actors, all right, but they are not the ones spending it. It's men. This is a particular way in which men tend to be wounded in their sexuality and are really struggling, and it really has impact on a number of levels. I've seen marriages. It is devastating to marriages, where many men do not realize that women see their husband looking at pornography as infidelity, all right? Because most men don't see it as infidelity, all right? But women, isn't this true, ladies, tend to see this as infidelity. You're cheating on me. You are cheating on me. And there's a sense of, I can't compete with that. You know, I'm a real woman, and I may not be 19 anymore, right? And I may not have a perfect body anymore. And I can't compete with those images. And so it is incredibly degrading and dehumanizing to women whose husbands are participating in that. So it has impact on a number of different levels. Prostitution reduces a person to an instrument of sexual pleasure, an object to be used. It increases the spread of sexually transmitted diseases. To protect innocent members of society, prostitution can legitimately be forbidden by civil authorities. It is more prevalent where culture exploits the physical and social vulnerability of women. Rape is an act of violence which a person forces a sexual act on an unwilling partner. Rape deeply wounds the respect, freedom, and physical and moral integrity to which every person has a right. It is always an intrinsically evil act. And now I want to talk about this next one, homosexual acts, because this is one where this is an issue today. This is an issue today where there is great, complete disconnect between the way the church understands sexuality and our culture. Homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered and immoral. All right? Now that's painful for homosexuals to hear, and that's painful for people who love homosexuals. All right? Whether it's your son or your daughter or your brother, your sister or friend, whoever it is, it's very painful to hear that. That is a very painful statement, that homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered and immoral. All right? They are contrary to the natural law. God did not create people in his original creation. God's original intent was not that there would be same-sex attraction, right? That is the result of the brokenness of original sin and then of personal sin, right, that comes into our lives. That was never part of God's plan. It is not. It is contrary to the natural law. They close the sexual act to the gift of life. So this is one of the reasons why we recognize that it can never be morally accepted by the church, is that even if there is great love that is being expressed between the couple, and even if that love is a commitment where they're saying that I will love you for the rest of my life no matter what, all right, which comes, you know, maybe very close to genuine love of a heterosexual couple, it can never, ever be open to giving life. They do not proceed from a genuine, effective, and sexual complementarity. Now, having homosexual inclinations is not immoral. It is homosexual acts that are immoral. We have to make very clear distinctions when we deal with homosexual acts and homosexual persons. Persons with homosexual inclinations are not any worse than anybody else. Right? We all have disordered sexual inclinations. Right? Even the most heterosexual person in the world has disordered sexual inclinations. Right? And so, for some reason, I think this is one of the problems that I see, is that we tend to treat homosexual sin as somehow worse than heterosexual sin. Right? So, for instance, if a couple are living together before they are married, right, and they're a heterosexual couple who love each other and are probably moving towards marriage, you know, how do we see that? If we see a homosexual couple who are living together, right, but marriage is never going to be an option for them, but they genuinely love one another, right, if we condemn that more than we condemn the other, I think there's a problem there. The reason the church says that homosexual acts are immoral is the same reason that it says that acts of contraception are immoral. And so essentially, couples who are contracepting are committing the same sin that homosexuals are committing. And that includes about 80% of all Catholics of childbearing age will at some point or another in their marriage will practice contraception. Now, we have to say it's wrong, and we do say it's wrong, but we don't need to say it's more wrong than use of contraception, the use of pornography, or any number of other sins. Somebody asked me today, it's like, you know, are homosexuals damned? And I said, well, homosexual persons, there's no sin involved there, so no, we don't talk about that. She said, well, what about if they are acting it out? And I said, well, first of all, I don't get into the whole damnation thing. That's God's job, right? It's God's job to decide who's going to go to hell and not. But if God's going to damn homosexuals, then he's going to be damning all the people practicing contraception, who are using pornography, who are masturbating, who are involved, who's are experiencing any other kind of disordered sexual activity. There's going to be a lot of people in hell. All right. If God's going to start condemning and damning all of them, right? That means that we don't get to condemn them either. All right. These are our brothers and sisters. We don't get to feel superior to people. We don't get to demean them and degrade them. Let's listen to what else it says here in the chapter. The number of men and women who have deep-seated homosexual tendencies is not negligible. It's not a small number of people. This inclination, which is objectively disordered, constitutes for most of them a trial. It's a very difficult struggle that they are going to have in their lives. Even those who have made complete peace with that, it is going to be a struggle in their lives. They must be accepted. This is for all of us. They must be accepted with respect, compassion, and sensitivity, whether they're practicing or not, whether they are celibate or not. They deserve the same respect, compassion, and sensitivity as any other person. Every sign of unjust discrimination in their regard should be avoided. These persons are called to fulfill God's will in their lives, and if they are Christians, to unite to the sacrifice of the Lord's cross, the difficulties they may encounter with their condition. Okay? Now we're getting close to the end. I'm going to have to wrap this up. And there's much more that you might want to look at and read there as it goes into a little bit deeper. This is an important issue. This whole realm of sexuality and chastity, because it is an area in which we all have to struggle. All right? And it is a reason that we see many of our marriages being damaged, right, and destroyed. It is where you see many people's lives being turned inside out and upside down. But we have to begin by understanding how good sex is, how good sexuality is, what an enormous gift and privilege God has given to us human beings to share with Him in this way, as procreators and as lovers. We have to be, unfortunately, the church's position has often been presented, we've started with a negative. That's the reason I tried not to do that for the first half hour. I didn't want to get into all these issues because that's where you get into the no, 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 no. I wanted to get into how beautiful and wonderful it is before we got into that. And I think that that is not how most of us learned about sex. It is not certainly how we learned about it within the church. It's probably not how we learned about it within our homes. Even parents, it's easier to tell your kids, don't do this and don't do that, and this is wrong and this is wrong, than it is to sit down with them and really explain to them what a beautiful, wonderful, sacred, and holy thing sex is. Because that might lead you into having to talk about what a really wonderful, holy, sacred thing it is in your life. And that gets pretty personal. And as parents, we perhaps are uncomfortable going that far with talking to our kids. And so it's easier just to sell them, don't do this, don't do that. Here are the negative consequences if you make these actions. And we don't hand on. It's not just the church. It's we as families. We don't know how to talk to our kids about this because it means we're going to have to get really personal. Really personal in an area that maybe we aren't entirely comfortable in talking about. But that's where it's going to have to happen. That's where we're going to turn it around. It's not going to be primarily preaching from the pulpit. You know, I'm not going to have an opportunity on Sundays to be able to preach an hour-long sermon, all right, to begin to address some of these topics. All right, so it's going to be you parents and grandparents who are sharing this with your kids. You are the primary teachers of your children in the ways of faith, in the matters of faith. And this is going to be one of the things that you, as parents, and your children, who, because I look around and recognize a lot of you, we're talking about grandparents now, you know, you're going to have to learn how to talk about this so that we can teach our children and teach the world what a wonderful, enormous gift God's gift of sexuality is. So, next week, we will be talking about Thou Shalt Not Steal, which is actually going to focus then on justice, the church's teaching on justice. So we'll get together then. Please stand and let's close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, deliver us from evil. Amen. In the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. Amen. Thank you.